Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will discuss China's human capital in the era of the fourth industrial revolution. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Scott Rosell, who is a researcher at the Freeman Spogli Institute for the International Studies and one of the co-directors of the Rural Education Action Program at Stanford University. Hello, Scott. How are you?
Good morning over there. It's evening here. It's really nice to be here, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Thank you. And indeed, we have again one of those podcasts where we are recording in between different time zones from the West Coast in the USA, Europe, and Taiwan. And I happen to be in the time zone of 6 a.m, so cope with me while the early morning coffee makes its effect. But let's get started with our topic. China has a human capital program, which is more complex issue that might appear at first glance. The world's most populous country recorded a birth rate of 0.75% last year, resulting in a natural growth rate of 0.034%. The National Bureau of Statistics said very recently, it is the lowest natural growth rate since 1960. But if aging is one element, there are other issues at stake. The huge rural-urban divide, which is growing, and the role of technology, for example, are just some of these elements which surface over the tip of the iceberg. Scott, can you help our listeners to understand this complex picture a bit better?
Yes, I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. I try to put sort of China into the world picture of development, right? I mean, China is a middle-income country now, and it's trying to move towards high income. But let's see, are they going to make it? Or how are countries that are like them doing? And if you look at sort of a map of the world and look at all the countries on a graph, and you put income per capita 70 years ago and income per capita today, you got, you know, the high-income countries, the OECD countries, up in one corner of the graph. You got the real poor countries. But I'm interested in two sets of countries. And one of them are what I call the graduates. So this is what China wants to be. They were middle income 60 years ago, and they are high income today. The interesting thing about this, there's only 15 of them. it's a hard thing to do. It's South Korea and Ireland and Israel and Singapore, the province of Taiwan, right, are those countries that have done that. Then there's the biggest group of countries in the world, which are the middle income trapped countries. They were middle income 60 years ago. They're middle income today. And they're the Brazil and Mexico and South Africa, et cetera. What's different between those? Why can have these few countries moved up into this high income category, but most of them are trapped down there? And what one of the big differences between these two sets of countries are the human capital of their entire labor force. And I use a metric that's created by in Paris at the OECD, which is that if you want to become a high income country, a healthy labor force has a very large share of everybody between 18 and 65 that has a high school education or above. Because as we say, you know, we're in the fourth industrial revolution. You're going to be changing jobs and there's new technology. You got to learn how to learn. And if you haven't been to high school, at least college, even better. But if you haven't been to high school, you're going to have a lot of trouble that in this economy, as you move to high income, you're fine in middle income. You still have manufacturing and construction and everything, but you move up here and now you're in this very fast. So the average share of the labor force of the middle income trap countries is only about 35%. So 3 out of 10 people have graduated high school, while 6 or 7 out of 10 have never been to a day of high school. Okay, that's Mexico, that's South Africa, that's Turkey. Okay, and they get close to high income, and guess what? That their labor force can't do the jobs of this high income labor force. But look at South Korea, look at Taiwan, look at Ireland, Israel is 70 to 80% of their labor force, 18 to 65, have been to high school or higher. That's exactly the same level of high income countries as the United States, as France, and as Belgium, and so that when they were middle income, they already had high income countries level of human capital, and that let them make this transition. So what's the question? What about China? When you compare China to all of these other upper middle income countries that I've been saying, China has the lowest level of human capital in the entire middle income world. Number one, low. And this isn't my data. This is this little 1.4 billion person survey they did in 2015, the census, and only 30% of the labor force have ever been to one day of high school. So in China, that's 560 million people. It's not high school. They're not a high school dropout. They've never been to one day of high school. And, you know, then you think, well, China is going to become this high income country. They're going to, you know, they're going to automate. They're going to shift the industries. You know, is this labor force going to be able to handle that? You know, a country, a high income country needs 10 or 20% of their population that does these manual jobs, you know, landscaping and nannies and cooking hamburgers, but you don't need 70%. And that's where China is. And I worry about that. I think that I always call it the biggest problem China has that almost no one knows about.
Thank you, Scott. That's quite worrisome at the same time, quite fascinating the way you put it, also in perspective to the other middle-income countries. We've had an episode about the middle-income trap here at The Sound of Economics together with Alicia, and we will link it up to this episode as well, because it's a complementary conversation that we already had here. So we are really monitoring this situation. There are a lot of issues that you put on the table, and a lot of issues related also to this aspiration of China to become a high income country, but also to develop further. One of the catchphrases that have been around for the past year or so has been the common prosperity narrative that we also have been dedicating some attention here. How those things that you said plays with this stated strategy from Chinese authorities? And then the second part of the question is related to technology. You mentioned technology, and we want to see how technology plays a role in all this and can really, for example, replace human capital in this broad set of scheme that you've been fleshing out.
Yeah. So there's really two questions. Let me take the common prosperity one first, because you know, I try to follow this quite closely. Anything you can add, I'll write down on my notes here. But China has one of the highest levels of inequality in the whole world. I think South Africa is number one. After transfers and everything, China's Gini coefficient, its measure of inequality, is probably but the second highest in the world. It's over 50 enormous difference between the top and the bottom. And mainly it's between the urban and the rural. That's the biggest one. And it's these rural, the rural population who are the uneducated. You know, 560 million people in the labor force have never been to a day of high school. Those are the rural population. That's starting to show now. The polarization has started in China. And I'll talk about this in a second. And I think that the government has seen that. And they say, okay, we really need to try to do something about this. I mean, it's been a long, long time. There's perhaps political, economic reasons to do it. And so they've come out and said, I've seen four policies that they said. So they say, we need to give everyone a chance to prosper commonly. Okay. So prosper means they need to keep growing. Okay. But commonly means they need to get rid of the inequality. Okay. And so how are they going to do this? Okay. And so it's clearly targeted at these uneducated rural workers and try to pick them up. So number one, there's two policies that are targeted at the rich, which is you got to give more philanthropy, right? And we're going to tax you more, right? We're going to tax big companies more. So philanthropy for the individuals and tax the companies. Okay, so we're going to get money here to perhaps solve this problem. Now let's go down and see the two policies focused at the bottom half of this income distribution. I see two that have been pruned. Number one, we aren't going to do welfare. That's the number one policy. So they're not going to take this money and transfer it to the poor. Number two, they say, don't lie flat. I mean, you probably know in Chinese, it's tangping, which means you need to work hard at this. There's a cadre of urban youth who are being accused of lying flat, which, you know, I don't have a job yet. I live in my parents' second apartment. You know, I go out with my friends, or I get a job, but I keep my head down and I do as little as I can. That's what people are talking about. Those people are already in the middle income level, though, that are lying flat. The one that are targeted by communist prosperity, there's not one rural worker who lies flat. They don't lie flat because, you know, if they become unemployed, there's no unemployment insurance. Zero. Because guess what? Rural workers can never be unemployed. That's true because they lose their job in manufacturing. We'll talk about this in a second because of automation or because of whatever. That you'd think they'd be counted as unemployed. No, they have a farm to go back to. So they're a farmer. So as soon as they get laid off their job, they're a farmer. And so they aren't counted. And I just don't, there's no rural worker that I've ever seen that doesn't work really hard. So they're supposed to work harder and they don't get welfare. And I just don't see where common prosperity is going to solve this problem. I mean, it's I think that now maybe it's too early in the process and they're going to turn and start focusing on education and health and adult learning, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, I'm so impressed that I'm speechless because, you know, it's so crystal clear and I can't agree more with what I heard, but I want to add something if I may. Perhaps we will see, you know, health, education, welfare, basically, you know, we are Europeans here, and Giuseppe and I, and, you know, we feel quite strongly about this. So as much as you may say, well, where is China? I mean, in Europe, we would say, where is China? Meaning, you know, three times as much, yeah, compared to where you sit. And I want to highlight this because still in Europe, I hear and I read articles on common prosperity as, in a way, the you know, the rewriting of a model that wasn't working. While we know clearly from Xi Jinping's speech on the 15th of October that that's not what he has in mind. He said it, he even mentioned it's like this welfareism, you know, like what we have here in Europe. Like, we're not even thinking of something like that. It's so inefficient, you know. So, of course, they're not going there. Now, the key question is, then where? Because you cannot solve a problem as big as that of China in terms of income distribution. And as you said, the missing link, I would call it the missing link, if you allow me. I mean, all of these 600 million people who are nowhere to be found other than the census. You know, they're not in the unemployment figures. They're not in the productivity figures. They're nowhere. It's half of the population. So if we can't find half of the population anywhere but the census, and we argue that we're not going to pursue welfare, I can't think of any other way to solve that problem, because no matter how big, you know, those corporate taxes in China have been going down since I started following China with this a while ago, just because, frankly, that's the way to give room to these companies to make them breathe. And I don't think that's going to change now, because they have a major problem, especially with smaller SMEs. I mean, if you have problems with SMEs, 6 million people are nowhere to be found. Unless you run a humongous, I mean, basically making Europe pale, okay, welfare program, you can't solve the inequality issue in China, and let alone the education issue, because it's related. Who's going to educate those people if you don't have a major welfare expenditure? And I just want to
who's going to retrain the workers, right, when they get laid off, right? I mean, same part of this welfare program that we need.
Exactly. So you just need to look at China's central government, because I mean, it's quite hard to do the local government part, but central government education expenditure, healthcare expenditure, and you compare with something called economic affairs, let alone military, but economic affairs, which is subsidies to make it, you know, industrial policy. I mean, you add the two plus pensions and you still don't get the same amount. So you would need to literally, and that's a problem, you would need to literally, change the economic model to be able to afford a welfare state. And that's the problem, that China's debt, public debt, when you include local governments, and if you include state-owned enterprises, is much higher than the US or Europe.
Property companies, real estate companies, developers.
Yes. So just add, imagine we forget about those. If you add state-owned enterprises, debt, of course, I don't know about the assets, but I don't think they are willing to privatize anything. So let's forget about the assets. Corporate state-owned enterprises, local governments, and central government debt, you're well above 150% of GDP. So unless they change the system, there's no money for those 600 million people you Steve, rightly so, want to re-educate or educate. And I think that's a reality. It's not so much they don't see it, it's that where's the money? That to me is the key question.
Yep. And it's even worse than that, right? The thing that people don't realize is, and especially Europeans, where the health system and the education system are centrally funded, and you know, basically schools, you know, in the smaller towns are funded almost the same as the schools in Brussels or Leuven or Bruges, right? China has 40,000 independently run school districts. The United States, we have 40,000 independently run, independently funded school districts, right? And so Palo Alto, you know, that's that city that's right over there, where Stanford is in the Silicon Valley, right? We have such tremendously high property taxes that go to those schools. We have fantastic schools, but you go to Fresno, California, right? It's 200 miles away, and their property is so cheap that, and they have so many kids, is that they have horrible schools. That's the same thing that's in China, is their schools are locally funded, hospitals are locally funded. And so, you know, that's the number one thing, you know, that they really, really have to change before they tax and give. So, you know, I think it's a serious, serious, you know, problem that has from the ground up, and it's going to get worse. In fact, you see it. What I often people say is, well, Scott, you know, you talk about this problem. Do you see it in the data, or do you see it happening now? And it's this hard to detect problem. It's the United States in 1980s, okay, where you know, we had had unions and we'd had high wages and we'd had protection for our workers. And then, you know, somebody named Ronald Reagan changed it all. And in the next 30 years, we had this massive polarization, right? Where and the polarization was driven by globalization and automation, right? Also. So what I want you to do, right, is look at China's own data. There's a set of graphs that take the labor force, not in agriculture. So put agriculture over there. It's totally informal. We're not even going to count those guys. But I want to count secondary and tertiary industries. So manufacturing, construction, and service sector. Okay. And I'm going to divide those into the formal economy and the informal economy. So the formal economy is state-owned enterprises, large enterprises, government officials, units are protected by labor laws. They're part of a unit and they get all the benefits from the state. Okay, number one. The other part of this secondary and tertiary economy, okay, is the informal economy. We call it the gig economy today, right? It's the people who squat and sell vegetables at your inn, the DoorDash China riders, the Meituan riders, the Didi, the Uber drivers, right? Those are the ones that repair bicycles, the ones that are out that don't belong to a unit. They really aren't covered by labor laws, really, and there's no benefits. 2005, almost 70% of China's labor force is in the formal economy and only 30% in this informal economy. Today, these are government statistics. These aren't mine. Today, it's the reverse. There's only about 30%, 40% of the labor force that's in this formal economy. Okay, now let's go look at where they are. You know what? Manufacturing, since 2017, manufacturing jobs have fallen. Construction jobs have fallen. And guess what? They get dumped into the informal labor intensive service sector, just like the United States, right? And if you look at wages for 15 years, 20 years from 2000, 2015, unskilled labor wage rose faster than GDP. Since 2015, that wage is almost zero net growth. And while, you know, the professional skilled wage is going up, so we're seeing this polarization already happening. And guess who's down in this informal sector? The uneducated. They'll never be able to take those jobs. And so since they can't take those jobs, what do factories do? They automate. China has more robots. China has adopted more robots in their factory than South Korea, Japan, West Germany, and the United States combined over the last 5 years, because they know that these workers aren't going to be able to adapt to this new high-tech economies, right? And what do? They, you know, go drive for Didi, right? And so, you know, it's a real, real, you know, issue out there. So it's a...
Scott, you started to reply the question of technologies just right now, but can we go a little bit more deep into the question? Because I think this is really key for understanding what's going on, you know, and that's also perhaps what, up to a certain point, the parallelism with other economies, such as, it's very interesting that you make this parallelism with the United States, and the way the situation is on the ground in both countries. But then when it comes to technology, maybe China, at least we have the perception that China wants to play ahead of the curve over there. And what's really at stake over there in the human capital, the conversation?
Does China have the human capital to create the technology they need to drive them through the next several decades? I'm not an expert in that. China has a lot of college grads. They have a huge engineering program. In the past, they've sent a lot of students overseas and they've come back and they've had a lot of foreign direct investment by foreign companies that have brought their technologies over. Okay. And those companies are still there. I don't think the problem is that they can't create the technology. In fact, What happened in every other country as wages got to the level that they got to in China in 2013, 14, 15, the unskilled wage, right? Is the companies all moved out. They globalized, right? And China said, you aren't going to globalize, okay? You're going to stay here. And guess what? We're going to help you stay here by subsidizing your automation, by subsidizing your robots. Firms themselves are also investing in there. So they want the automation. And it's happening at a massive, massive rate. We took a trip to, when I was teaching in 2018, we took our students to Shandong, a part where there's a big textile county, okay, textile production county. And we went into these factories and the general manager took us around there and we saw no workers at all. And he says, oh, he was so proud. He says, oh, we laid off 5,000 workers over the last 5 years and imported these junior computerized textile machines. And now we have five people working where there used to be 150. And guess where those five people are? They all came from the computer science department of Shandong University. So the five computer scientists took over 150 of these jobs. And where are those rural workers? They're dumped into the service sector, right? And so that's what's happening all over China. I don't worry about the factories being able to survive, right? What I worry about is what do you do with the 500 million unemployed or underemployed people, especially when their wages start to fall? Let me tell you one thing. We want to draw a parallel. Mexico, do you know what Mexico was called when I was in graduate school? It was called the next Taiwan because it had grown, it hadn't grown 40 years, it had grown 22 years in a row at 8 to 10%. And wages had gone from 25 cents an hour to $3.50 an hour by 1990. And everybody, they entered OECD. They made high income, right? You know, guess what? Their labor force was so poorly educated, better than China is now, but it was so poorly educated as they started shifting all these industries, they couldn't keep up. And Mexico collapsed. And they haven't grown for 30 years. And crime rose, gig economy rose, okay? And so I'll stop there. But I think this interaction between technology, I think China can make it on the side of producing the technology, but its impact on the population is going to be massive.
But Scott, this impact on the population somehow, and going a bit more into the economic planning part of this story, how this interacts with the strategy of the dual circulation, for example, which is that idea of expanding and decoupling the internal market while keeping the this export oriented economy, which can run also with the machines and so on, you know, at the same time. But then there is also this idea that there should be an internal market which should be functioning and where there should be a population who has the purchase power as well in order to make this internal market work. How these two things plays together with the kind of picture that you just told us?
Okay, so yeah, I think that's I've thought a lot very hard about this because, you know, I hear about rural revitalization and these building of the fourth and fifth tier cities, right? And then you start to think, okay, yeah, how does this work? Well, you know, we're going to make, China has 2,000 fourth and fifth tier cities, okay? There's 2,000 county seats, right? And prefectural seats, 2,000 of them, okay? And we want each of those to have, you know, well, you need 200,000 people in them. Well, so if you have 200,000 people in each of these fourth and fifth tier cities, it's not a huge city, but it's a pretty big city. That's 400 million people. Okay. That's what they want. That's their goal. Okay. Who are those 400 million people? Well, wait a minute. Terry Sickler from Western Ontario University and her colleagues have a great paper called The Rise of the Middle Income Class in China. And they go show that the middle income class is now 350 million, almost 400 million people. It's bigger than Europe's middle income class. Okay. Now, it's not in percentage terms, it's not. The problem that she doesn't talk a lot about in there, it's a great paper, is there's 950 million low-income people. So, and that's who we're talking about. These are the undereducated, unskilled workers. They're the ones that are going to go to these fourth and fifth tier cities. No middle-income person would move there. So now we have 400 million low-income people. And you remember, you know, Lee Keqiang himself said that 600 million people live on less than 1,000 yuan per month. That's who's going to move into these cities. Okay, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? How does that drive your economy? Do they do agriculture? No, people are leaving agriculture. Do they do manufacturing? There's going to be no manufacturing in those fourth and fifth tier cities. There may be a little construction at first, but that's not going to go anywhere. They want this dual circulation economy driven by the demand for services. But low-income people with no welfare, Alicia, don't consume services. So now you have no manufacturing, no construction, and a population that doesn't consume. They can supply cheap services, but nobody to demand them. I don't get it. I just don't see how this works, right? There's not a macro model that makes this work. So.
Indeed. I just have to jump in. I can't agree more. I think this is actually, there is a way, but I think the whole claim is that China is moving out of that way. And that way is to keep things as they are in terms of, let's call it social dual circulation, if I may coin this, all of a sudden, this expression. And why dual circulation? Because you could keep the hukou as it is, you keep the 600 million there doing agriculture or whatever they may want to do. They may not add to the consumption, but they don't add to the problems. And you apply the concept of common prosperity to the rest. That's the one and only way. But that's not what is claimed to be. The whole idea is that you're bringing those to that common prosperity. So, but because if you think of anything like, you know, like, I don't know, like free minimum income or you name it. Yeah. I mean, as you know, we Europeans have been exploring the Finns and the Spaniards, and, you know, with this, but not for 600 million people. And
where do you get the money?
Yes. Again, I mean, it's all back to the money. So I think that's not supposedly the model, but it might eventually be. Because there's no other way out. I mean, you know, like what my concern, and that's why I would say social dual circulation, is that they may have to accept that a part of the population doesn't move up if there's no other way out. Because I don't think they will revert a model of believing technology. I mean, they are in this tech-driven innovation, total factor productivity, as if total factor productivity were only R&D, you know, like R&D in China has ballooned, where it's actually now exactly the same as European average, 2.2, I believe, latest data of GDP. Of course, it's still very low compared to South Korea, but South Korea is a very homogeneous country. They even lower than Japan or the US, by the way. But the point is, for China to get there, you would have to squeeze everything else. And that's, again, including subsidies, by the way, to other sectors. And that, I think, it's not going to happen. So because they can't change the economic model, which is very costly in terms of support, financial support, because innovation is not all, or R&D expenditure is not going to be all to increase productivity, because they don't have an existing model of redistribution, they may end up accepting, I mean, unfortunately, accepting that they still need to keep that divide, that in a way common prosperity is is against, or at least that's my understanding of it. But they may rewrite the story and they may say, well, you know, for those who are not productive, though, or educated, there is no such thing as common prosperity, because I just can't think they can apply this to everybody, to be frank, certainly not with the tools available now, as you said, taxes and you know, and the goodwill of some billionaires. Even forced goodwill will not make it anyway.
So what I respond to that, I 100% agree. There's not one thing you said that I don't agree with that. It's very well said. What I question is, what happens out in that other, the second society, right? The dual society, right? The second society. Every single dynasty is brought to the ground by rebelling peasants, right? And when do peasants rebel? Well, guess what? I love the work by former Harvard professor Marty White. And yeah, I don't know if you've seen Marty's work, but you know, for years, Marty was worried about this inequality, or studying this inequality. We're all worried about it, but he was studying it. And he'd go out and interview the people in the bottom, the uneducated and the really low income, right? And they would say, you know, do you know that China's really unequal, right? And what do you think about it? And for 20 or 30 years, he did these surveys. And basically, over and over, what people told him was, one, hey, we know it's really unequal here, all right? But two, what they've always said is, but I'm better off than I was 10 years ago. I'm better off than my mom and dad were at this time of their life. And I think I'm going to be better off in the future. And guess what? That binds people into the system, right? And because, I mean, no one wants to go get in a gang and start extorting and start, you know, start crime syndicates or selling drugs. And nobody wants, do you think all those, you know, the people in Mexico wanted to do that when they had to, when they started doing it? In the 1980s, it was one of the least crime ridden countries in the world, right? But it was once, you know, once they saw the future was bleak, then, you know, guess what? 80% of them say, I'm going to suck it up and I'm going to go to the gig economy. I'm going to sell as many, you know, tortillas as I can, wash as many windows, you try to get my kid to school. And, you know, but, you know, there's a subset of them that are just going to say, nope, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go to crime. And, you know, it's unfair. I'm going to maximize my utility by doing that. Yep, I may be killed, but that's better than the future I see. And I think that that's out there. It's not there now. You see little tweaks of it in my interviews with rural people. But, you know, right now, growth weight of that wage was zero in 2016, 17, 18. I don't know what it is after COVID. I'm sure it's lower, but you know, everybody blames COVID. So, you know, I think that we need to watch what's going on. But if you dual society, which they're doing, right? That's what's going to happen. And so I agree exactly with you, but I don't think they can have a peaceful existence between these two societies in the long run.
Thank you, Scott. And I have to say that we could discuss this for much, much longer, but the time that we have for this episode is running out. So, but as I said before, this is a conversation we already started in previous episodes, and we are definitely coming back to the topic here at the Sound of Economics. And I just would like once again to remind our listeners that this was part of Bruegel's focus on global China seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite all of you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Scott, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining the conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been great. I've learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Giuseppe. Thank you, Todd.
And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.